Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we're going to talk to Soapbox friend and my dear friend, retired Colonel Ann Wright, about her recent trip on a female delegation to Korea, where she visited North Korea, and they had a peace march through the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone. It's a very fascinating interview, so stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Ann Wright. Ann Wright, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy.
Well, it's always great to talk to you, obviously. And you, I could probably talk to you every week because of all the things you do for peace and social justice around the world.
Well, thank you. I, like you, try to stay very busy with whatever each of us can do to help the world be a better place and stop these endless wars.
Well, Anne, your recent adventure was going to Korea, and you and I were in Korea many years ago together. So it's a place that really is deeply involved in the global military, U.S. military junta or whatever you want to call it. It's just really a global disaster at this point. But you had a very creative protest there. Tell my listeners about it.
Well, it was called Women Cross the DMZ. And it was a group of 30 women from 15 countries under the leadership of a Korean-American woman named Christine Ahn, who helped get everyone to Korea back in, what was it, 2005?
Six.
Mm-hmm. Christine's vision had been to bring international attention to the fact that 70 years ago this year, in 1945, the Korean Peninsula was divided through an arbitrary decision by the United States and the Soviet Union. Korea was divided on the 38th parallel. And since then, North and South Korea have been bitter enemies in a way, the governments. But
Right. The
people themselves have been divided with millions of families who have been unable to see each other, except on very rare circumstances when political tensions were lowered and groups were able to go to North Korea and to South Korea. But in the last 10 years, the tensions, with a lot of it being the United States, with its 30,000 U.S. military still stationed in South Korea, and the large, large military exercises that the United States and South Korea does, which keeps North Korea on war footing, because they feel, the North Koreans feel, that they don't know whether or not these exercises could transmute quickly into an actual attack on North Korea. And certainly with George Bush having in 2002 declared North Korea as one of the three axes of evil, and the continued tensions really since the latter days of the Clinton administration, the North Koreans have been on kind of a trigger point. So this idea of having citizen diplomacy and 30 women from 15 countries to try to battle the bureaucracy of both North and South Korea to get permission to go to each country and to go actually through the demilitarized zone, which was something that very few groups, only two previous to ours, had been given permission to actually travel through the demilitarized zone. That was kind of the genesis of this trip.
And what happened?
Well, what happened was after a year of negotiations, primarily by Christine Ahn and Susie Kim, who's a professor of Korean history at Rutgers University, and the work of Cora Weiss, who is a longtime peace activist living in New York City and who knows virtually everybody in the United Nations, they were able to broker deals with both the North Korean government and South Korean government and with the United Nations that this group could first go into North Korea and have 5 days in North Korea where we met with North Korean women, and we had an international peace symposium with North Korean women where they told us about the experiences of first living through the Korean War and the horrific, horrific war that most Americans, you know, in America it's called the Forgotten War for a variety of reasons, and one of it is the forgotten statistics where 4 million Koreans on that tiny little peninsula were killed during that war. And it was a 3-year war. You know, in Vietnam, that thing went on for 15 years. And millions were killed there. But that was in a 15-year period. Terrible. But in this concentrated 3-year period, there were 4 million Koreans killed. They say between 500,000 and 1 million Chinese were killed. And for the United States, something like 40,000 Americans killed in that 3-year period. Mm-hmm. So the intensity of that conflict is horrific. And the stories that you hear both in the North and the South of the brutality on all sides, to include the United States, and then the splitting of the country so that the families have been torn, ripped apart.
Right.
All of this being a reason that now for the, you know, there never was a peace treaty after it. It was only an armistice, So one of the missions was to try to get international attention to say that there needs to be a formal peace treaty negotiations and that there should be an opportunity for families, family reunification to occur, and that women should be a part of the peace process. Those are the three goals that we had. So off we went to North Korea. You know, and getting visas for North Korea is always a challenge, but that was worked through. And then having the meetings with North Korean women and then going on trips through the North Korean countryside, as well as visits to various institutions in Pyongyang, the capital, was all very, very fascinating.
And how was it? I mean, we both went to Cuba. That was my first time in 2007. Was that your first time to Cuba also?
Well, I'd been to Cuba actually in 2003, I believe it was, and then that in 2007, and then went back again just this year in February of 2015.
So what I was getting at was that we're told all these lies about Cuba. I was born in 1957, and then the revolution happened, and Cuba, you know, became a communist state. And so we were told all these lies. At least I was told all these lies about Cuba my entire life. And then I go to Cuba and find out that it's almost 180 degrees different from what I have been, what we in the United States are told. When you went to North Korea, what was your experience there about, you know, we're told that it's just practically a vast wasteland of devastation.
Well, yes, I totally agree with you that it is very important for all of us to travel to the places where our government tells us we should not go.
Right, exactly.
Because the vision of our government and the propaganda that our government puts out is different from the reality that you see. I will say, though, that Pyongyang, the capital city of North Korea, is very reminiscent of many communist capitals, former communist capitals. I mean, I, as a U.S. diplomat, was in Central Asia and the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, and I've spent time in Moscow. And the types of building construction are the very same things, these monolithic, huge, huge buildings. The veneration of the leaders of the country is just startling in a way, that everything goes back to the great leader, and the whole history of the last 70 years all put on the three leaders of the country. The veneration is out of sight, and the level of control on the people is certainly there. I mean, and the issue of human rights violations, the issue of gulags, where if you cross the government in any way, then you can be banished to horrific camps. That is all there. That said, having talked to internationals who were in Pyongyang while we were there, who have been to Pyongyang over a period of years, and hearing their version of how it is changing, because we really couldn't tell in our little five-day visit, and we were certainly taken to the places where the government wanted us to see. But in those times that we were able to talk to internationals, they were able to tell us that things are changing slowly, that that people are able to dress in different ways. And it kind of follows the line of what happened in China, what happened in Russia, as slow, gradual changes happened, that things are moving a little bit, that people have the opportunity to buy different kinds of things, that they're, and this is mostly in the capital city. We really didn't see much other than the tourist areas outside of Pyongyang, and we were never able to go to like a collective farm and talk to the workers on the farm, although we saw them as we went along the highways to get to these tourist areas. You could see hundreds of people laboring in the fields, planting rice by hand, using oxen as the mode of agricultural plowing rather than tractors. But the thing that I would bring out is that there definitely seems to be a feeling of the need for talks on reunification, on reconciliation and reunification. And I don't believe that's just a government propaganda tool to try to get sympathy in the world. I think there is a real thought by most people that the only way out of this corner that they've been put into, some by their own doing and certainly by the international community with the endless sanctions that they've had on North Korea and the endless war games that are directed toward it, is that there's got to be a peace treaty and a reconciliation that might lead to reunification. So it was hard to come up with a definitive statement based on only 5 days of being in a place. But I think we did get a certain sense that there is an opening, and that if the governments are not willing to work on that opening, then it's up to us, the people, the international and citizens, to try to open up a dialogue, which I think that we have contributed toward.
Absolutely. And do you have any, I know you've been a couple other places doing your good work that we want to talk about, but do you have anything else to add about your recent trip to Korea? I mean, you've also been to Jeju Island, which I think is a major topic of conversation.
Well, that's right. After we were in North Korea, and then I'll just mention that we did have a walk, a peace walk, while we were in Pyongyang, the capital. 7,000 North Korean women dressed in their beautiful Korean dresses lined the streets of Pyongyang as we walked through them, and then they followed in a large procession, starting out under the massive statue of two Korean women. The statue must be at 200 feet tall. I mean, it's huge, of two women leaning together over this big boulevard, holding hands for reunification. So 7,000 women and then this international group walking for peace. The next day in Kaesong, the village that's a town that's close to the DMZ, 2,000 women came to the streets in their beautiful Korean outfits with us. And then we were met in South Korea after we went through the DMZ by hundreds of South Korean women. And then in both Pyongyang and in Seoul, we had international conferences for peace. Following all of that, then a delegation from our women crossed the DMZ, went to Jeju Island, a little island off the coast of South Korea, which has been a focal point of international activism as well as South Korean activism, because the South Korean government has now built a huge, massive naval facility, a naval base, on a pristine island, an island of peace, and then on a culturally designated area, an endangered species area, they've built this massive naval base. It's the third time that I've been to visit on Jeju Island in solidarity with the citizen activists there. And the first time I went, the base had not, the construction of it had not started. And tragically, despite the heroic efforts of the citizens of south of Jeju Island, that base has been built.
Crazy.
And I'll just add that it gives even greater impetus for us to show solidarity for the citizen activists in Okinawa, where the U.S. military itself is planning on building another military base on Okinawa that will actually have a runway that goes out into a pristine area of the South China Sea in the calving grounds of the marine mammal called the dugong.
Right.
That has not started yet. That construction has not started, and it's really important for us to show solidarity with the people of Okinawa that say no more bases on our island.
I was there a few years ago at their little camp they have, and those are in Okinawa. Those are some very committed activists. I mean, they take their boats out and they like occupy the big construction things that the U.S. military has built out there, and they're pretty badass there in Okinawa. And you know, there's quite a huge peace movement in Okinawa, but like you said, on Jeju Island, despite everybody's efforts, the U.S. military still worms its way into and just causes so many problems. Now, Okinawa has had so many problems because of the U.S. military, having a profound presence there.
It does have a profound presence of over, I believe it's over 30,000 U.S. military on Okinawa, and the issue of not only the military exercises that happen there, but the issue of sexual assault by U.S. military on Okinawan women and girls, it has been horrific. And, you know, the base in Jeju Island, although it's not called a U.S. military base, it will be home porting South Korean military destroyers that have the Aegis missile defense system, which is part of the U.S. missile defense system. And no doubt it will see a lot of U.S. military warships that will be coming into that port to use that as another forward deployed area for U.S. military.
Well, it's just, just proxy. And I think that many of our so-called allies, the U.S. allies, of course, they lay down the welcome mat for the U.S. military and corporations that profit and things like that. So, I mean, South Korea is definitely, the government goes against the wishes of the people, just like happens here in the United States so often. And, yes, you know, we know what committed activists they are there in Korea. So let's talk about the other things you've been doing, your trip to Cuba, and I forget what other trip you are.
Well,
I can't keep up with my own life now. Try to keep up with Anne Wright's life is impossible.
Well, not only Cuba, but I'll mention I went with School of the Americas Watch to El Salvador.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yes, and the reason to go there, of course, is to talk to the Salvadoran government about stopping sending their military to the School of the Americas, or now called the Western Hemispheric School for International Cooperation.
Right.
And El Salvador's president right now is, interestingly enough, a former FMLN guerrilla.
Mm-hmm.
That fought. He's a commandante in the FMLN, and now has been elected president. And so of all people, we were encouraging him. We were hoping that he, with his background, would say, of course we're going to stop sending all of our military to that school that trained the assassins who kept El Salvador in turmoil in the late 70s and 80s. What he told us, though, was that his administration is slowly reducing the number of people that are going, military that are going. Last year he said that only 20 went and that they are looking for other places to send them. So while he didn't say he would stop, mm-hmm, the indications are that they are looking for other places to send them. But we would like to chalk up on the list of those countries who are not sending, who are refusing to send to the School of the Assassins, El Salvador. So we'll keep putting pressure on him. That said, the country of El Salvador is rolling in violence again, and this, mm-hmm, is part of gang-related violence, where now El Salvador has more murders than even Honduras, and this is all gang-related, and many there are very concerned about the heavy hand, they call it the mano duro,
mm-hmm,
approach, of not only this administration but the previous one, where There, about 3 years ago, there was a lessening in the number of homicides or murders in an effort to reach out to the gangs to try to find some settlements. But now the approach is a very heavy-handed one, which is now creating more and more murders in the civilian community. So El Salvador, again, finds itself in a horrific place where hundreds of Salvadorians are dying each year.
Well, and it's like South America, Central America is a place where the United States has used just such horrible violence and oppression, and it takes a rare person like someone like Hugo Chavez to stand up to the United States. And I haven't really gotten into this too much, but there's much out there where people think that the United States gave him cancer somehow. And so it can't really blame the president of El Salvador for not just all of a sudden going, stop, you know? So I see hopeful things happening in Latin America with the leadership standing up to the United States and joining together. So hopefully that will only increase.
Well, we certainly hope so too. And however, the level of violence that is going on now in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico,
right,
in the gang related violence that is stemming from the continued use by American citizens, U.S. citizens,
right,
of drugs, is another reason for us to push the debate on the whole drug scene in the United States and the total failure of various administrations' war on drugs.
Well, also the CIA is, a major drug dealer, I think. And Colombia had 9 U.S. military bases, and many people in that region, which I've been to a lot, believe that it is to protect the drug trade.
Well, and when you add to that Afghanistan,
right?
Every year that the United States has been in Afghanistan from 2001 on has seen an increase in the amount of drugs that are being exported from that country. I mean, it's a little suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a little. So, Anne, we're actually out of time, and it's been far too long since we've talked to you, but how can my listeners find out more information about your awesome activities?
Well, thank you. I still have a website, voicesofconscience.com, which is a link to a book that I co-authored called Dissent, Voices of Conscience,
mm-hmm.
and then a Facebook under Anne Wright.
Well, also, we want to say that August will be the 10-year anniversary of when we first went to Crawford, Texas, to confront George Bush about the wars and everything. And so we're putting together a 10-year anniversary. Unfortunately, it will be in Texas.
And unfortunately, in August.
That's, you know, where we started. And so we want people, there's a Facebook group called Camp Casey 10-Year Reunion. So we'd like people to come out. And we have quite an extended Camp Casey family, but you don't have to have been there to actually join us, because the peace movement really needs to be revitalized. There's so many issues that are important. And I've been accused of being a one-issue person, which isn't true at all. But I think war and peace is the most important issue. If we could solve that, it would go a long way, I think, to creating a more compassionate, healthier world. You know, for example, if we weren't paying so much money for Empire, we can afford university, a free university for people. We could afford health care, and, you know, just making, if we made the United States a better place, I think it would go a long way to making the world a better place.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I would echo your comment on Camp Casey reunion. This will be a very, very important meeting, and it'll be a time for us to put our heads together again about new strategies, new tactics for getting more participation on issues of war and peace, against war and for peace. And even though it's Texas and it's August, it will be a very rejuvenating time. Your whole body will be cleansed because you'll sweat it out of you there. So we hope that everybody that's interested in peace throughout the world will join us in Dallas, Texas, the second week of August.
And we're not going to Crawford again, but George Bush still lives. He lives in Dallas now, and George Bush is still a free man, which to me is unacceptable.
Well, that's right, and we will be going to the War Criminal Museum of the former President of the United States, and to his house, or as close as we can get.
The library.
The library, yes.
L-I-E, Barry. Well, Anne Wright, we love you, and thanks so much for your work, and thanks for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox again.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
All righty. Well, that's the Soapbox for this week. As always, I hope you were informed and inspired. As always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. I'd like to thank Anne Wright for all the wonderful work she does around the world. And as always, I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting the show. Speaking of supporting the show, please go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com and give a donation if you liked it. And please share the show with your friends and loved ones and people you don't like. Maybe it will annoy them. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.